This is the rite of the giving of water, and none will look away. 9 armored warriors, the entire assault squad, surround the kneeling apothecary as he unscrews the stopper, then tips a few drops out onto his segmented glove. Their armor is gunmetal gray, edged with white and red, and the desert has coated them all with a film of white dust. The threads of water make stark black streaks on the dusty metal of his gauntlet's fingers. As the brothers intone the sacred rite, voices toneless as they rasp out through the visor speakers, Memnes dribbles the water onto the rock he has chosen. In a second, the sons have baked it away to nothing, but the rite is nevertheless made. Water has been given. Precious drops from the raging salt oceans of their homeworld, Ithaca. They were born from a world of seas, raised from it like the great horn-plated waterworms they name themselves after. To them, it is the embodiment of the Emperor, who they voyage space to serve. Wherever they go, they make this offering, the life water of Ithaca, the blood of the Emperor. This place, called Rosetta on the arcane charts shown to them at briefing, this place is now consecrated. Water has anointed this vast landscape of heat and dust. They are iron snakes. The double-looped serpent symbol stands proud upon their auto-responsive shoulder plates. They are tactical squad Damocles, charged with this holy duty. They stand in the ring as Brother Memnes rises to join the circle. 10 warrior gods in the form of men, armored and terrible. They sing a slow ritual tune and beat time in deadened clanks, slapping right hands against their thigh plates. Their weapons have been made safe for the rite of giving of water, as ready weapons would be disrespectful. They chant over. They move with smooth precision, clicking sickle-pattern clips into bolt pistols. Brother Andromach connects the power feeds to his plasma gun. Blue lightning crackles into life around Brother Sergeant Raphon's lightning claw. He nods. The circle breaks. The salt pan glows like milk in the sunlight. Visor tints and nictating bionic eyelids dim the glare to a bright blue translucence. The brothers are silent as they skirt the littered rocks along the edge of the depression, moving single file through the shadows. 2 suns have risen. One, dull and fuzzy like an apricot, the other vast and sizzling and too white bright for even their visors to negate. The third, a tiny spot of heat like a melter flame, will be over the horizon in 4 minutes. In line, then, Brother Sergeant Raphon, Brother Andromach, Brother Priad, Brother Calignes. A break of 10 paces, then in file, Brother Pindor, Brother Chilis, Brother Xander, Brother Machid. Another break, then Brother Natus and Brother Apothecary Memnes. Brother Andromach carries the chapter standard, the snake crest, double-looped, pinioned above his shoulder blades. No words are spoken or needed. Visor arrays are matched by sharp senses. Ranges are judged and logged. Terrain is assessed and scanned. Brother Sergeant Raphon uses his Auspex to watch ahead. They know why they are here and what they must do, and when they must do it. A low wind rises in the east, shivering across the pan. It picks up salt dust as it goes, brushing the fine white powder into eddying cones. The dust seethes, flicking like foam off rock outcrops or churning in lines across the flat. The dust ripples look like snakes, Brother Priad thinks, or like waves breaking on a rocky shore. He nods at Brother Calignes, a good portent. At the head of the snake of men, Brother Sergeant Raphon sees it too. He knows the dust has been stirred up by a solar wind, precursor of the third sunrise. The third sun is small, but its radioactive force on Rosetta is fiercely powerful. Triple dawn is almost upon them. With a gesture of his hand, he double times them. They crunch on through the indigo shadows of scattered white rocks, bleached like teeth. The iron snakes pass into a canyon, starkly black and white with its division of shadow and light. Shadow and light. The key to this. Beyond, below, in a dimpled basin scoured from the pan, lies the target. Rayfon sees it for the first time. Rosetta Excelsis Refinery 9. A 10-kilometer-square edifice of riveted black metal and orange pipework, looking like a wasp crushed into the desert by a great heel. Oily girderwork laces the structures, and pouting, soot-mouthed stacks vent dark fumes and the occasional flame-bellied belch of smoke into the crystal-blue desert sky. Rayfon looks at it for a while. A few seconds, probably, but for him an eternity of contemplation. He knows, for he has been told, that this is a vital facility, sucking black fluid out of the porous rock buried deep beneath the salt pan. 10 weeks ago, the pipelines that run from here to the cargo port at Alpha Rosetta sputtered dry. The precious supply of fuel had been staunched. Without its flow, the armored battalions of the Imperial Guard on half a dozen neighboring worlds had ground to a halt. Rayfon opens his comm, selecting the command channel.
Damocles, I witness to you the target. We will begin on my word.
Liberate, they were ordered. Brother Librarian Petrock, Great Petrock himself, had given the briefing. Liberate the facility and the fuel supply. Exterminate any who oppose. Such simplicity. Rayfon smiles again, feeling the hungry weight of his bolter in his right fist, the warmth of the lightning claw that encases his left. The third sun rises. A brief and extraordinary phenomenon striates the desert salt pan. The three opposing suns, with their trio of conflicting intensities and directions, fill the stark whiteness with a startling crisscross of shadows. The desert becomes a checkerboard of darkness and light, grey sidelong slants, fathomless pools, intersections of harsh glare, as stark as snow. It is called the Risings, Rayfon knows. Librarian Petrock was quite specific. At this hour, for 4¾ minutes, the conjunction of sunlights make a shadow maze of the landscape.
Damocles, move!
Their window of opportunity. 10 armored warriors descend the dimpled slope at a run, crossing shadow and light, lost like sifting sand in the complexity of the flickering crosslight. Chapter 2. Brother Rayfon reaches a sloping wall of iron-buffered siding. He scales it, ripping handholds with his claw, sliding over the top to bring his bolter to bear. 2 men guard the parapet. 2 men dressed in refinery overalls, augmented with sections of body armor. The backs of their tunics are marked with sprayed stencils showing the vomitous sign of the ruinous powers of Tsinch. The skin of their faces is dark and knobbed, like the hides of crocodiles. They have injected fluid tars under the skin to taint it, and buried metal piercings, girder rivet heads, in the flesh. A mark of honor, so Librarian Petrock said, of membership to their foul cult. They stand by their pintle-mounted autocannon, watching the sun rise, feeling the warmth on their lumpy, black faces. Rayfon fires twice. One drops without a head, the other reels, his spine removed in an explosion of blood, gristle, and bone shards. Brother Andromach reaches another part of the perimeter. The alternating light and dark flicker of the three suns is confusing him. But Sergeant Rayfon explains how this would be to their advantage. He kicks open a shutter door and enters the gloom, squeezing the grip of his plasma gun. Things with bright eyes set in black faces look up for a second and then die, screaming. Brother Prius leads the assault over the north wall. Grenades loop from his hand and scatter like seeds across the grilled deckway. Explosions rattle the length of the wall line. Somewhere an alarm starts to whoop. They are in. Pindor crosses an open space between derricks, blasting freely. Huddles of bleary enemies stumble outside in confusion and are cut down as they flee. Calignes enters a service vault by the north wall and finds 3 cultists struggling with the tripod of a storm bolter. He saves ammunition and butchers them with his knife. Chilis and Xander catch a dozen of the enemy as they panic. They impose a crossfire that pulverizes all. More emerge, firing back with las guns and autocannon. A searing shot marks Xander's shoulder guard with a denting scorch. Memnes moves in around them, setting up a third part to the crossfire. Like the three suns with their inescapable shadows, the three tracing lines of their bolter fire pummel into and explode corrupted bags of flesh. Memnes chuckles as he does the Emperor's work. Calignes moves from bunker to bunker, slaughtering. Through one doorway, he turns to face the stained features of a screaming heathen who opens up on him with an autocannon. Thumped backwards three paces by the succession of impacts to his carapace, Calignes grunts. His bolt gun has been blown from his fist, and his smallest finger has been vaporized. The autocannon cycles suddenly on empty, and as the cultist gropes for a reload, Calignes rushes him, exploding his head with a clap of his augmented fists. The iron snakes move deeper into the facility. Between two low concrete blockhouses, Maked is rushed by 20 cultists who stream over him like ants, bludgeoning him with girder strips and wrenches. He laughs as he kills them, crushing necks, splintering limbs, punching his fists through bodies. His battle dress now dressed with blood, he churns through the gore into the control room and tears the cultist he finds at the primary console into two twitching pieces. His laughter rolls through the comm. The other snakes rejoice in it. Raphon kills as he laughs with a shot from his bolter. Priad fires on full auto. Andromach scorches. They kill and kill again. Something stops Chilis in his tracks. He pauses, almost thoughtful, trying to make sense of things, struggling to overcome his clinically trained battle hunger. He stands on a derrick walkway with a good view of the control center. He looks down. There is a hole clean through his torso, a hole that passes right through him. As his legs give out, Chilis screams in rage. He was not finished. His face hits the grill deck, denting it. They all feel his death. Through the rapport of interfed life signs, they all feel it. The iron snakes mourn Chilis even before he has fallen, and they see his last sight. The traitor marine, the hulking, pustular form of a dark tusk warrior, cackling over the smoking muzzle of his weapon. Eyes wet with anger, Priad turns to find another dark tusk mere paces from him, charging with a rusty barbed lance. Priad can smell the rot in the air, the fetid stench of corrupting matter. A bolter is not enough to cleanse this filth. Priad bowls the primed grenade in his hand with such fury it smacks the dark tusk off his feet as it strikes him in the gut. He falls, almost comical, spread-eagled around the impact. Then the grenade ignites. Priad is drenched in mauve fluid. It clogs his vents for a moment, and he falls, choking with the stench. As he gags, he sees the feet beside him, the great steel-bound boots of another dark tusk who is standing over him, whooping and sucking with liquid laughter, about to fire. Raphon kills it. He squeezes the trigger of his bolt gun until the entire sickle clip is empty and a hurricane of rounds have hammered the Chaos Marine into a heap of organic and metal wreckage, wreathed in a mist of blood. Raphon pulls the choking Priad to his feet.
More than we thought, he rasps.
Is it not the way?
The way of killing.
Just so. Give me more. Make them lethal. Make the fight worth fighting.
Raphon clips Priad on the shoulder in respect and encouragement as the younger brother reverses the cycle of his helmet vents to expel the ichor clogging his intakes. They turn. There is another scream. Maked is dead. Poisonous splinter barbs from some inhuman dark tusk gun have blown his legs and lower torso to shreds. A dirty, toxic knife has silenced his screaming rage. Vengeance burns in their throats, making them as dry as the salt pan. As he strides forward with Priad, Raphon uses his Auspex to judge the deployment of Damocles. The surgical precision of their strike is melting as the men turn back to avenge their fallen brothers. The assault is hesitating. Raphon will not allow this. Keying open his comm again, he barks off a string of orders that redirects and fortifies the ebbing wash of his men's advance. He quotes the motivational sermons on the use and abuse of vengeance in battle that they all heard during tactical indoctrination on the fortress moon Charybdis. Memnes supports him, cutting in on a sub-channel, singing the battle dirge of Ithaca that glorifies the dead in the Emperor's name. Raphon and Priad meet with Andromach and Xander at a railed walkway by one of the facility's wellhead arrays. There is a fog of liquid oil in the air. Xander finds Mached's corpse, sprawled in pieces on the shadows of a ductway. He signals Memnes to it. The apothecary arrives, opening his belt pack for the reductor and the other tools of removal. Mached himself is beyond the help of Memnes's Narthesium. The bright steel tongs of the reductor are already slick with Chilis's blood. With deft but reverential hands, Memnes strips open Mached's chest armor and begins to dig the flesh apart for the sacred progenoid gland. Such rare treasure, the genetic wellspring of a space marine's power, cannot be abandoned. He pulls it free, a glistening thing, drops it into a chrome bowl, cleans it with a spray from a fixator, then places it carefully into a self-locking, sterile tube. He stoppers the tube and slides it back into the rack in his Narthesium, next to the one already holding Chiles's gland. There are 8 empty tubes just like them. Bestial wails and calls reverberate the ironwork. Andromach and Xander have cornered a dark tusk. The exchange of fire is brief but intense. Xander takes a hit that rips a thermal waste dissipator off his backpack. In return, he puts a bolt around in through the dark tusk's left visor socket. As the chaos servant falls, thrashing, Andromach roasts him slowly with his plasma cannon. Raphon and Priad skirt the vaulted bunkers 100 meters west. Sharp slabs of sunlight interlace long shadows thrown by the buttresses. Priad sees where the etched inscriptions on the imperial iron facings, eulogies to the golden throne, have been defaced and overwritten with dripping blasphemies. He starts to repeat the dirge to soothe his mind. Raphon silences him. Drips of something like tar soil the white sand in the sunlit openings. They think they have another of the tusks, gone to ground between 2 pump station units, but the pulsing machinery is fogging Raphon's auspex. The tusk comes on them from the rear, grabbing Raphon from behind with great armored limbs that lock around his throat. It drives a barbed and rusted spike through his left hip. Priad turns and dives into them, so that the 3 sprawl, locked, armor grinding and scraping together. The tusk is half as big again as either of them, ancient armor black and shiny like a great scarab, dressed with filthy loops of chain. Priad twists, fighting to get his bolter close to the vile thing's face. Blood in his mouth, Raphon fights the tusk, fights the grip, fights the pain. He writhes to give Priad a clean shot. The spike breaks. It shatters inside Raphon. He blacks out. The tusk gets a hand around Priad's wrist and hauls him over. But this is a mistake. It has cleared the shot. Though still gripped, Priad fires twice, the point-blank shots shattering the tusk's helmet and skull and igniting its power pack. The blast lifts Priad and Raphon and tosses them 10 paces. By the time Priad is on his feet again, they are lying in a wide pool of blood which is streaming from the spiked hole in Raphon's armor. The wound is huge. Blood drizzles out from under him, through the buckled puncture in the plating. Wordlessly, for to speak would be to scream, Raphon shudders and uncouples his lightning claw. Priad wants to argue, but knows this is not the time or the place. Raphon has been grooming Priad for command responsibilities since Priad's induction into Damocles 5 years earlier. Priad has always hoped that such an inheritance would be a long time coming. He pulls off his own left gauntlet and arms himself with the claw. He plugs the power lead into a rune-shaped socket on his elbow. Gold-leaf traceries etch the knucklebacks of the ancient weapon, recording its history and uses. The commander of Damocles' squad has always worn the claw. Priad flexes its fingers as the electrical charge shimmers around it. On the ground, a stiffening island of metal in a lake of blood, Raphon opens his command channel and begins his eulogy, his passing over, instructing them all to answer to Priad. He is finishing, his voice fading, when Memnes arrives. The apothecary clasps Raphon's naked hand once as a gesture of honor. He opens his Narthesium for medical tools.
No time,
Raphon murmurs. Memnes scans, concurs. Rayfon's pelvis is shattered, and his lower abdomen is laced with metal fragments from the shattered spike haft, still impaling him. With a ship's infirmary, care, time, and bionics, it would be reparable, but there is no time, and the spike was venomed. Filth and toxins permeated the traitor marine's weapon, plague spores that blister and chew their way through Rayfon's body, despite his superhuman, implanted metabolism. Soon he will be a tainted slab of decaying flesh. The progenoid gland, too. Memnes removes the gland. He doesn't wait for Rayfon to die. Despite the pain of the extraction, Memnes believes that all marines would rather die, knowing their legacy had been saved. The surgery wounds, rending and deep, kill Rayfon. They are, perhaps, a blessed relief from the toxic wave that sweeps over him. Another tube for the rack. Chapter 3. Priad opens the command channel and speaks to his men. They hail him with grim solemnity and utter devotion. Rayfon will be mourned later. Natus reports the southern perimeter secure, and Pindor and Calignes add that all opposition has ceased. In 13 minutes, they have killed 311 of the foe, including the Dark Tusks, for the loss of 3. It has been a costly victory. The Iron Snakes regroup at the main gantry as Memnes and Andromax torch the corpses of the foe, and lay out the 3 dead Iron Snakes with honor and ceremony. Working from stored instructions in their helmet memories, Priad and Natus toil to re-engage the pipeline so that fuel pumping may recommence. Calignes searches the scrappy and incomplete log entries of the refinery's control personnel. He draws Priad across and shows him what he has found. Listings of anomalous core samples and petroleum spectrographs. 3 months before, to the day, Rosetta Excelsis started to suck something other than oil up from the desert aquifer.
"There is something down there," Calignes says. "Something foul and ancient that has slumbered in the oil reserves for..."
He does not finish his sentence. Time passages of that length are beyond his ability to guess or articulate. Priad is silent, numb perhaps. Their mission here, the directives of which he has inherited and intends to carry out with loyal precision, were to recapture this valuable wellhead. It was assumed that the forces of the enemy had overtaken this place to disempower the Imperial army. That is shown to be a lie, and the deployment of the Dark Tusks to bolster the cult's troops now makes sense. There is something valuable to the ruinous powers here. Some artifact, perhaps, some icon, some thing of power, perhaps even an entity buried deep below in the lightless lakes of oil. Damocles has won the facility, discharged its mission at great cost, and yet it has lost. They have won a place that is worthless, seized back precious imperial territory, only to find it now tainted and despoiled. If they had known, from orbit, they could have... Priad pauses. He clears his mind with slow intonations of the focus chant. Disappointment is a mind poison. So is the thought of failure, or the loss of belief in either cause or purpose. Calignes knows it too, and follows Priad's lead, casting out the negative senses of loss and error gnawing at him. He needs no cue or command to do this. They are Adeptus Astartes, Iron Snakes chapter. There is no failure. There is no defeat. There is only victory and death, and both are to be savored when they come. Priad looks around, imagining the moment when the refinery first spewed up the taint from deep below. He feels a tiny stab of pity for the workforce, men he has helped slaughter this day. Loyal servants of the Emperor turned to the ways of darkness by something that they began to exhume from the depths. There is no choice now. They must do what should have been done first of all. Priad orders Natus to stop work on the reconfiguration of the pipeline pumps. He summons Pindor and Xander and makes them assemble all the explosives they can find. They take the full complement of grenade munitions from each space marine, then search the weapons stocks of the enemy for more. Memnes enters the gantry, and Priad quietly tells him of the discovery. Memnes thumbs open the neck seals of his helmet and removes it. His scalp is shaven and beaded with sweat. He wipes a gloved hand right back across its stubbled dome, his old face dark and serious.
Your decision is correct. You do as Rayfon would have done.
Though second in the chain of command under the squad leader, the old apothecary has seniority on his side, and his assent is always noted by the leader. Memnes knows that is what Priad, a marine barely half his age, is looking for.
We have not failed. It is simply that the nature of the victory has changed, Memnes says.
I know it. We will make true victory from this spoiled triumph, and celebrate both in the Emperor's name.
Pindor reports that the munitions are collected. They load them into a cargo cart and push them to the wellhead. Natus and Andromach take drill weights off one of the main bores and strap the explosives into place, lashing them into mesh ore sacks. They are half finished when the counterattack comes. A bombardment from the east that fractures the perimeter wall and flattens two derrick towers in a frenzy of sparks and shrieking metal. Roses of fireballs bud into the sky. Priad has signaled their egress to the east, and now he countermands, asking for a western extraction. The change will add 4 minutes to the Thunderhawk's flight time. Pindor works to complete the stowage of the explosives. He is stripped down to the waist to allow him access to the cramped space under the boarhead, his armor stacked nearby. Fluid heavy feed lines cross his naked carapace from the belt mount, held in place by flesh staples. His shoulders bear the old scars of punishment rituals carried out on Charybdis. Pindor always scored low on morning firing rites, but his expertise at close fighting and explosives have made him indispensable. Scar tissue, puffy and pink as coral, bunches and twists as he works. The enemy advances from the east, more long-range bombardment, and then the first signs of troops. Dark tusks in two assault teams, with razorbacks in support. Damocles have no long-range weapons, nothing with reach like the razorbacks. Resistance at this point would be futile. Priad orders midday prayers, and they circle around him, kneeling, helmets off, heads down, as he chants the litanies of devotion, the psalms of destruction and fortitude. He does it so they will not even consider the idea they have failed. No one voices such a thought. He asks each man in turn to speak a word for the fallen. Calignes remembers Chilis, a moment of bravery on Paradis Antimony. They all nod, remembering. Xander shows a scar that would have killed him on Basalt Igneous III, but for Maked. Maked is remembered too. Natus celebrates Brother Sergeant Rayfon's tactical skill and his bravery. Andromach recalls the day Chilis slew a water worm on beloved Ithaca. Naked on a rock tower, with a sea lance braced. He took the horn hide. The polished scales were still looped in his belt when he died. Memnes speaks well of Maked, reminding them of his brute strength against the grisly Honek on Parleon 111. Chapter legend, a legend that has died today in flesh, but which will live in memory. And not, Priad reminds himself fiercely, in vain. Pindor joins them, still half-stripped, dripping sweat and oil. He kneels and tells a short, gutsy story of Rayfon at the gates of Fugal, blinded by mud and killing all the foe he could find, cursing all the while for a good sea lance to test them. Pindor draws their laughter, honest, forthright, uplifting. No hint of defeat or failure in them now. As is should be, thinks Priad. We have won. The snakes have won, no matter what.
I have done the work,
Pindor tells Priad as the laughter subsides. They help Pindor redress his armor, while Calignes cycles the rock bore to dig and sends it down. Oil waste flushes up around his feet like a black tide and then seeps away down through the mesh of the gantry deck. The foe is at the gates. A tumult of voices and gunfire. Helmets in place, the seven iron snakes withdraw in close file down the main cargo avenue under the shadows of lifters and skeletal cranes. They fire as they go, lacing bolt traces and plasma fire into the buildings and niches. At the west cargo gate, they form into a spearhead as the Tusk advance guard rushes them down the avenue. Blisters of light mark the air, exploding metal bulkheads, breaking girders, and digging white powder from the ground. A descending hellstorm chasing after them. The snakes drop two of the foe with concentrated fire before Priad orders them out of the gate. He himself pauses in the archway long enough for the first Tusk to reach him. Priad disembowels the disgusting creature with the lightning claw, in Rayfon's name. A saved grenade brings the cargo gate down after him, and they are moving into open desert, away from Rosetta Excelsis, with the chaos advance momentarily halted. The stark light of the midday suns burns the landscape white and shadowless, and there is no longer a horizon between bleached land and colorless sky. The gunship awaits, hazed by heat and dust, in a narrow arroyo. Its entry ramp is down like a tongue in the soft dust. Bolter rounds whine after them as they board. The dark tusks have broken through in pursuit. Memnes and Priad in the rear turn and engage for one last time, killing as if to underline the undeniability of their victory. Chapter 4. From space, the surface of Rosetta is hard and white and sharply scored, like the back of a dry skull. They are just making transitory orbit when the munitions fire, 900 meters down in the oil reserves. There is no visible sign from up here. Almost an hour later, the surface turns dark and puffy, like wet rot, the patch extending for 3,000 square kilometers around the focus of the refinery. Subcrust fires, linked to magmatic disruptions and fueled by some unknown source of exploding power, burn out Rosetta a day later. In the dank belly of the gunship, their discarded helmets rolling on the metal floor in little circles as the ship pitches and yaws, the survivors of Damocles sit in silence. They are tired, blank, parched. They mourn. Now, and only now, do they allow themselves the thoughts. They have lost, yet they have won. They have taken a victory, the right victory, but not one they expected, or were sent to achieve. Memnes takes out his flask. It is tubular, copper-banded, with straps of dull zinc. He draws it from a sheath on the thigh of his armor. This is the rite of the sharing of water, and none will look away. Six armored forms, the remains of the assault squad, watch as Priad takes the flask. He wants for cool, slaking water, but he knows this must come first. A sip of the salt water of Ithaca. He swigs it. It is sharp, warm, saline, bitter. He looks up at them all, and they pound their thigh armor in approval. The ceremony is over, but the bitterness in his mouth remains. Whether it's from the water of his homeworld or the mission, Priad isn't sure. Part 3. White Heat. Undertaking to Idon. Chapter 1. Green Rock. Amber Sky. White Heat. It was all revealed in a lurid glare that slanted in through the widening aperture of the whining hydraulic landing ramp. The tip of the armored ramp crunched into the mica glass dust of the landing circle. The oily piston struts hissed to a halt. Steam dissipated, and there it was. Idon. A precious, ancient world, and one possessed of a savage, natural beauty. So thought Petrock, chapter librarian, as he stepped down out of his landing shuttle and surveyed the open majesty of the land. He was framed for war, bareheaded and clean-shaven, his black locks bound up behind his deep skull, a towering form tall and broad even for a space marine. The edges of his gunmetal gray power armor were lined with white and red. But he did not lack a soul. Idon was starkly beautiful. The rocks in the landscape around the blasted landing circle were vivid green, semi-crystal, glittering in the warm, clear air. Along the skyline, jagged vents spat white fire into the air. The phosphor fires, burning up from deep seams and faults in the earth beneath, powered the foundries and smithies of venerable Idon City. White heat, the flames that kept the smelters and manufactories of Idon turning in the Emperor's name. Petrok remarked upon the majesty of the place to his Lexicanium, Rhodos, as they walked together down the cinder path from the landing circle, under shattered rock-crete arches, towards the main Imperial staging post, their bearers in procession behind them. Rhodos looked at him as if uncertain as to whether Petrok was joking or not. Petrok decided to drop it. If the man couldn't see it, then there was no point explaining. Some Ithacan hearts, he knew, were too ironclad to see anything but war. Petrok wondered if the fact that he could see the beauty was his weakness or his greatest strength. Doom had come to Idon the year before, when the Dark Eldar had taken it in a single night. The action had marked the start of a renewed period of primal raids, as the foe launched out of their shadowy fastnesses and hiding places to strike into the reef worlds. Due to the strategic position of its base world, it was the chapter's blood privilege to bear the brunt of all incursions into this part of the Imperium, and it had been so since records began. Imperial guardsmen, a massed force of 300,000, mainly Leoparda stormtroops and Denorian light armor, had been deployed to Idon in the first months to effect a liberation. They had failed, ground to a standstill. Freeing six squads of the Fratri from the ongoing reprisals against the Dark Eldar incursions elsewhere in the Reef Worlds, mighty Sadon, master of the chapter, had sent his snakes to succeed on Idon, where the Guard had foundered. The force was led by the veteran Hero Captain Phobor and by Librarian Petrok. Petrok's landing had been delayed by an orbital bombardment. By the time he and the young tonsured Lexicanium marched into the Imperial staging post, Phobor was already leading an assault on the southern walls of Idon City. Petrok could hear the crack and volley of the distant fighting rolling across the gritty green slopes, and he could see the smoke pall rising 3 kilometers away. The white phosphor vents on the skyline continued to rasp and blur the amber sky with their primordial heat. The staging post was all but empty. Half a dozen sculptural white awnings, discolored slightly by months of exposure to the heat seer, swayed in the breeze. There were rows of smaller habitants made of a darker, coarser canvas, and stacks of munitions under netting in sandbagged dugouts. Several armored vehicles were parked nearby. They had been painted with a lime overcoat to mask them in the green landscape. Behind the main command tents, on the lee of the hill, rows of infirmary tents stood all the way down to the roadway in the valley. Petrok could smell the rot and disinfectant drifting up from them. Guardsmen in the livery of the Leoparda saluted as the great librarian approached, his quite formidable Lexicanium a step behind, carrying the casket containing the librarian's holy tarot deck on a padded satin rest. Behind them came the bearer of Petrok's ornate helmet and the bearer of the power sword, Belus. Behind that strode two more bearers swinging censers and holding fluttering pennants of the Charybdis Fratri aloft. And behind them walked four more, carrying the sacred Book of Lives in its litter-like hardwood chest. All the bearers were robed, hunched, homunculus figures. One of the guardsmen pointed at the main tent. Petrok saw how he was trembling, his face pallid and dank despite the midday heat. Without speaking, Petrok advanced towards the tent. His bearers snuffled and growled sidelong out of their cowls at the guardsman, making him dart back. "Enough of that," Rhodos barked at them. Inside the tent was a vast round table, the surface of which was a glass plate illuminated from beneath by moving lights that showed the contours and arrangement of the city and the disposition of the troops. Guard officers stood around it, and they all looked up and stepped back solemnly as the distinguished warrior and his retinue entered.
"I am Petrok of the Iron Snakes," he said, as if any here could not know who he was.
One, a Leoparda general by his sleeve bars, stepped forward.
"Major General Corson, welcome, great sir. Your worthy commander has already begun his assault.
He requests that you make your strategic assessment as soon as possible so that...
Petrok held up one huge, armored hand.
I am well aware of what my commander expects of me. Show me the dispositions.
Corson led Petrok to the table. The librarian looked down at it, his sharp eyes clicking as they took in every detail. Every flickering unit light point, every drifting rune. Those eyes fed the data back into his brain, his greatest weapon, where they could be composed, considered, analyzed, dissected. He smiled.
Master?
Rodos asked, noticing the expression.
3-point fluid dispersal along 2 insertions. Typical of dear Captain Phobor, just as he did on Tull.
Rodos gazed at the tabletop for a moment, trying to discern the pattern.
I see,
he said. He did not, and Petrok knew it. Rodos had a long way to go before he would master the techniques of memory and comparison that allowed a great tactical mind to take in all battle assessments at a glance. But the real reason Petrok had allowed himself to smile was not his immediate recognition of Phobor's favorite tactic. It was a simpler thing. The table reminded Petrok of the strategium board where he had learned his craft from his old beloved master, Nektor. It was a whimsy, but it pleased him to enjoy it. He had, as he liked to remind himself, a soul.
These here, he asked, tapping the table plate with his fingertips. 3 battalions of Leoparda, in reserve.
The Major General's voice was hollow and scared.
Why? Your brave captain wanted them out of the way. He was quite insistent. He didn't want them to...
Confuse his aim,
said a Donorian officer smugly from behind, clearly enjoying the Leoparda's discomfort. Petrok smiled again. He could just imagine how Phobor had roared in here, accusing the Imperial Guard officers of weakness, cowardice, incompetence, and every other sin under the suns. They had failed to discharge the Holy Liberation, and Phobor would make them sweat now and repent in punishment details later. No wonder the camp was terrified. There was some muttering in the officer ranks, and Petrok frowned, still looking at the table.
Silence!
Rodos growled, noticing his librarian's furrows. Hush fell again. Even the bearers had stopped their growling. Petrok put his hands on the tabletop and leaned down, looking deeper, no longer making a tactical forebrain assessment. He was reaching out with the darker, more profound parts of his mind. He was using his gifts to see beyond the now, into the when and the if, to sense the fortunes of the battle. A chill fell on the tent enclosure. Frost formed on the tabletop glass around Petrok's hands. One of the junior guard officers fainted and was bustled away out of sight. The bearers began to murmur and bark until Rodos quieted them with a savage look. Petrok ignored them all. He was locked with the patterns of past, present, and future. He was seeing behind reality, watching the way the structures moved and meshed. It was perfect. Phobor's ploy had been entirely appropriate. The vanguards and support lines were placed correctly. Idon City would fall within 4 hours, with minimal losses on their part. His report would convey little to Phobor except to bolster his confidence. Except something. Something small and awry. Something persistent and nagging. Like a tiny pebble lodged inside the cuff of a Terminator glove, niggling away. What? What?
Master?
Rodos asked. Petrok stood back.
This,
he said, pointing to one light on the eastern side of the illuminated chart. Rodos consulted the key.
Damocles squad, Master. Captain Phobor sent them round to ensure the foe would not break from the city when it fell. A sound move, but it troubles me. There is heavy fighting there.
The chart doesn't show it.
I feel what glass and electrocrystal patterns do not. Damocles is in danger.
There, but one unit, said another Leoparda general, speaking up. Surely the overall victory is paramount. None can be spared or freed from the main assault to support them. Losses are inevitable.
The general fell silent as he realized he had said too much. Petrok looked up, but there was compassion in his eyes. He knew how hard the guardsmen had been driven to conquer the superior foe, and he knew how bitterly Fobor had railed at these men.
"You're right, sir," he said. "Lives must always be secondary to victory. But I will not see Ithacan souls wasted where waste is unnecessary."
He turned abruptly and tugged his great power sword from the sheath the waiting sword-bearer held. The bearer started in surprise. The blade, great Belus, glowed and hummed as it breathed air again.
"What are you doing, master?" Rhodos asked.
"What I must. Wait here. I will render my tactical survey to Captain Fobor when I return."
Despite their fear and their awe of Petrok, the guard officers began clamoring to a man. Fobor had left them with one task, to greet the great librarian and speed his assessment to the front line. Fear for their lives made them question the huge, armored figure in the doorway of the tent.
"Shut them up, Lexicanium," Petrok said softly, as he strode outside, beyond the baying chatter of the soldiers.
As the librarian made off across the green rock, towards the white heat, he could hear Rhodos shouting, "Silence!" over and again.
Chapter 2. In a green rock defile on the eastern edge of Idon City, washed by the stink of the phosphor vents so close nearby, Brother Andromach of Damocles' squad cursed Idon in the name of every spirit he could remember as he blasted away with his plasma gun. In reply, enemy shots whickered down the gully and blew one of the biting snake finials off the chapter standard he wore over his shoulders, the snake crest double-looped.
"Back! Back!"
snarled Brother Pindor from behind, half-dragging Andromach towards the cover of the gully wall.
"There's no way through there!" "You think I don't know?"
bellowed Andromach, fussing at his hot weapon, replacing a feed line that was about to melt out.
"Commander!"
Brother Sergeant Priad heard Pindar's cry over the voxlink as he sheltered from a blistering enemy salvo behind a green boulder. He tried to make sense of the terrain and find some gaps in the enemy fire. Curtly, he called Calignes, Ilias, and Xander forward. They made a few meters before a round tore through Xander's shoulder plate and they dived for cover. Too heavy. Too much. Priad cursed. He'd rather be back home on Ithaca, hunting waterworm, than caught at a dead end like this. He had cursed too when Captain Fobor had sent them east to act as a guard in case any of the dark foe tried to break out of the city as it fell. Priad had felt Damocles had been cheated of sharing the victory. He'd wanted his squad to join the main assault. Now they were sidelined and all but forgotten, and none of them could have predicted the fierce fighting they would encounter. Priad couldn't explain it. It was as if the Dark Ones had already recognized their defeat and were fighting to retreat east out of the smeltery city. Damocles was the only unit in position to quell the retreat. Splinterfire lanced around them. Apothecary Memnes was beside Priad suddenly, dropping into cover from the rapid dash he had made. The faceplate of his helm was burnt and dented by a glancing shot.
"Memnes," Priad growled, "explain this."
"I can't, Brother Sergeant," the elderly warrior replied gruffly. "We were meant to be a safeguard, so Fobor said. It feels like we're meeting the main force of the enemy."
Priad fell silent. He surveyed the blistering firefight through the enhanced optics of his helmet. None had fallen so far. Andromach and Pindor were buffered in the gully. Calignes, Ilias, and Xander were pinned in the open. Natus, Cylon, and Cools were ranged out behind the position he and Memnes shared. A hail of gunfire rained down from the steep, stone slopes of Idon City before them. Apart from local vox traffic between the members of the unit, communication was down, drowned out by the static of the erupting phosphor vents. Even through his respirator, Priad could smell the heat sink of the firewells. They could no longer even tell how the main assault was going. Perhaps Fobor and his squads were strewn dead across the western bulwarks of the city. Perhaps they were alone. Priad slowed his breathing to clear his mind. He looked across at Memnes, and though he saw nothing through his visor lenses except Memnes's buckled faceplate, he could sense the old, wise face beneath it, the compassion, the support. "You will make the right decision. We trust you,"
Damocles trusts you, brother sergeant. Priad flicked out the data slate from his thigh pouch and checked again across the detailed light map of the city's eastern approach. He studied the ground's swell, the access points, the fortifications. The Imperial planners had built it well. And these dark Eldar had taken it in a night. Curse them. Damocles would do the same in an hour. He slid a stud on the side of the slate and overlaid the structural data. It showed the density and thickness of the rock walls, the hard points and pilings of the defenses. It betrayed the actual physical weaknesses of the land and buildings they fought for. Something. Something. There was indeed something. Priad switched the overlay back and forth, matching and rematching. According to the old charts, there was a section of the east wall built of compacted rock shards rather than ferro concrete as an expediency during construction. Priad felt his palms dampen with anticipation inside his gauntlets. He rolled onto his backside, his shoulders against the rock, and began to copy the data from the slate into a vox message for Andromach. Dark Eldar splinterfire stitched the green rock around him and covered Priad and Memnes with a fine lime-green dust.
Andromach, Priad rasped over the helmet vox to the squad's standard-bearer. Open your data link and stand by to receive.
Andromach responded, a clipped atonal bark over the metallic vox. A red light on Priad's armor cuff glowed darkly to show that the link was open, and Priad sent the vox picked.
I see it, Brother Sergeant.
Andromach's tinny voice came back.
You want me to hit it?
Count of four, Andromach. You have the plasma gun. Bring that wall down at its weak point. Damocles, stand ready to go on five. As soon as Andromach lays in, move out and follow through.
His voice was a robotic, emotionless growl through the comm, but the other Marines' voices responded as one, unfaltering. Even Apothecary Memnes, who was right beside him. Priad checked his bolter and his lightning claw. The claw sizzled in the dry air, hungry for blood. Priad prayed to the lost soul of Brother Sergeant Raphon to watch over Damocles from his place high up in the lost heavens, where the oceans surged forever and the Emperor knew each man's name, and the worms rose eternally for the great hunt. Let us be sharp and true and fast as a harpoon, Priad thought. Raphon, help us take the foe as we would a worm rising from the seas, without flinching, without balking. Make our thrust the victory thrust. Priad made the count. On four, Andromach swept up out of cover and sent a blazing blue spear of plasma energy down the gully with pinpoint precision. Green rock exploded in a vomit of flame, brighter and louder than the white heat crisping and fountaining along the horizon. Damocles moved. The Space Marines broke from cover, firing as they went, gunning up at the walls. Smoke washed across them. They made 10 meters. 20. Then Priad saw the wall. It was unbuckled, unbroken, still standing, despite the oozing, molten burn Andromach's plasma gun had inflicted upon it. The Dark Eldar, invisible in their positions above, renewed their fire. A splinter shot clipped Cylon's leg and spun him down. Cools faltered as glancing shots whipped around him. Natus went down, crying out as his left arm came away raggedly at the shoulder in a spray of fire and blood and armor shreds.
Cover! Cover!
Priad yelled. They fell into cover, Memnes dragging the crippled Natus into safety behind a rock. Enemy shots filled the air around and over them, or chipped and shattered the rocks they clung behind. Crystal dust and weapon smoke washed across the approach. 20 meters. They had made just 20 meters, and still the wall stood. The available cover was so slight that Priad was forced to lie face down in the green dust. He turned his head sideways and saw Ilias lying on his back next to him. A smoking hole had laid Ilias's visor open, and blood was dribbling out. Ilias had lost an eye and a cheek to a rebounding splinter round. Priad crawled over, pulling out his medical field pack, spraying jets of wound-sealing skin wrap into the helmet hole. Ilias was still conscious. His fortitude was astonishing, even for a space marine. He mumbled some poor joke to his brother sergeant, though half his face was gone. Priad could smell blood. He thought it was Ilias's until he realized that was impossible. He glanced down and saw the raw, black-edged hole in his thigh. A splinter round had punched right through his armor and through the meat of his leg. There was no pain. Adrenaline was washing the agony away, that and the augmented systems of his body. Later, there would be pain, but that was not his chief concern. He hoped his Astartes physique would be enough to fight the venoms and filths with which the Dark Ones coated their weapons. But the wound had self-cauterized. He would not bleed out, at least.
"I smell the blood of a hero," said a voice through the vox link.
"Who's that? Who speaks?"
Priad rolled over, daring more volleys of enemy fire from the fortifications above.
"Who?"
There was a figure behind them on the green rockside. An iron snake, tall, bareheaded, swathed in a cloak, stalking forward, oblivious to the rain of fire that doused the ground around him, but miraculously left him unharmed. He held a sword aloft, a power sword that sang like the shrill keening of a waterworm.
Petrok. It was great Petrok himself.
Chapter 3. Petrok dropped into cover beside Priad.
"Well met, Brother Sergeant," he grinned.
"Well met indeed, Master.
Your leg wound, does it pain you?"
"No, sir. I can move and fight if I have to, and I know I must."
"You honor Charybdis with your bravery, leader of Damocles. Your men?"
Priad gestured sidelong to the 9 space marines, sheltering from the storm of fire.
"Natus is crippled, his arm gone. Ilias, there beside you, has been injured gravely. The rest are more or less intact."
Petrok rolled over next to the sprawled Ilias. He looked down into his face.
"You'll have a noble scar, Ilias."
"Thank you, sir."
"Don't thank me. I didn't do it. The wound wrap is holding and the blood is stemmed. You're strong. Your body will fight any venom or taint. I'll personally ensure you get the best new eye if you'll fight with me."
"Eye or not, I'll fight with you anywhere, anytime,"
Ilias said, fury in his voice. He wriggled over and grabbed his fallen weapon. Petrok looked across at Priad.
"A fine squad you have here, Brother Sergeant."
"Thank you, Master."
"Call me Petrok. It's quicker and simpler in the heat of battle, and I like my friends to know me by name."
"Sir, Petrok."
"Better, Priad. Now advise me of your situation."
Priad gestured across at the insurmountable fortifications.
"Captain Phobos sent us back here to watch for a retreat." "Typical of the captain's textbook moves,"
Petrok mused, with a grin that made Priad smile involuntarily.
"I didn't expect much. Truth is, I thought we had been given a secondary role. But the resistance is huge, as if they are already breaking or guarding something important."
"A good assessment, Priad. I felt as much. So you know, Phobor is taking the city as we speak. But this here is unwarranted. I came personally because it troubled me. I hate to lose any of our ironclad brotherhood. You're a first-caste worm-killer yourself, aren't you, Priad?"
Priad started at the recognition and felt a flush of pride despite the tumult around them.
"It was my honor to take a worm first-caste, sir."
"Petrok,
Petrok." "Yes, in the summer of my admission to the Phratry. I took a worm with my first harpoon in the Channelways, beyond the Telos Archipelago."
"So I know. A proud achievement. It took me 3 harpoons before I took my first. You should teach me sometime."
"Sir, Petrok."
Priad was laughing despite himself.
"What do you think they're guarding?"
Petrok asked directly.
"I don't know,"
Priad replied, suddenly serious.
"Something of value. Great value to them."
"Indeed. Your tactics so far?"
Priad flexed his aching leg and checked his bolter clip.
"We assaulted, as simple as that. When we ran foul, I tried to get Andromach, my plasma bearer, to take out this section of wall, where a weakness seemed to be."
Priad showed the slate to Petrok.
"But the gambit failed, and so we are dug in."
Petrok regarded the slate Priad had given him for a moment, as further splinter rounds cracked into the green rock around them. When Petrok put the slate down, it was covered in frost.
"You were right, Priad."
"Sir?"
"Petrok,
Petrok,"
the librarian smiled at Priad. It was unnerving to see an unarmored face. Priad almost shuddered.
How was I right, Master Petrok?
He asked.
You took your worm with the first